Committee on Revenue for April 27, 2007 will come to order. I think I have a quorum for a work session, so we'll open a work session on House Bill 2172. I'm going to close that work session. I'm going to announce first that there are two bills that we seem to be having a lot of problems with that are, again, not ready. And I apologize in advance. I know there are a number of people here for them, but there's no point in me having you sit for 2 hours and then have it not come up. So let me tell you now that we're not going to be hearing House Bill 2369 House Bill 2692. Have I got that right? The two bills having to do with the 911 tax. Did I get it wrong?
No, you did it right.
I did it right. 2369 and 2692. There turns out to be there's some more glitches on those bills that we have to work out, and so they won't be heard today. And people here for those, and if that's the only reason you're here, unless you really want to be involved in other matters, you don't have to stay. Thank you. And then we will reopen the work session on House Bill 2172. Committee, we have amendments on that bill, and we're going to let Chris talk to those, and I think there's some people from the department who may be able to help us understand them. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2172 does a number of things, and it affects two credits. It extends the current credit for purchasing qualifying diesel engines, and it also creates a new credit for the repower or retrofit of credits of engines. And you have in front of you a dash 5, which is about 8 pages long, so it's a fairly lengthy set of amendments, and they came out of a work group that was chaired by Representative Butler to work on some of the issues that had been brought up during the public hearing of the bill. And Mr. Chair, I can walk through these, or would you like to call them up, or do you want me to just march through them?
Whatever you think is most likely to get the committee up to speed
in the most efficient manner.
Yes, because we have a number of things left on our calendar.
Okay.
And if you'd like them to come up, why don't we bring them up? The people from the department who can explain the amendments to us, that would be helpful. Thank you. And if you would identify yourselves for the records, and then we'll have a conversation about these amendments as we go through them.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator, DEQ. And I'll just really briefly describe the amendments for you. As your staff indicated, we had a work group chaired by Representative Butler. We also had Representative Reed, Bob Russell from the Trucking Association, Lindsay Capps from the Oregon Environmental Council, Deborah Buchanan from the Department of Revenue, and Kevin Downing from the department who's sitting with me today. The primary amendment had to do with repowering of engines. Repowering is when you take an existing vehicle and you take the engine out and you put a new or rebuilt engine in it. And the original bill had some provisions in there to limit the total cost of that provision. We required that that repowers would have to meet a cost effectiveness test and be at least 25% cleaner than the engines that were replaced. But we added a number of changes in the amendments to further restrict the cost of this provision. First of all, repowers with the Dash 5 amendments would be limited only to non-highway engines, so we wouldn't be repowering trucks, on-road trucks. They could still be retrofit under the bill, but repowers would only be for non-highway vehicles, such as construction equipment and barges, where it's a very cost-effective way to reduce emissions. We also limited the tax credit for repowers to just 25% of the qualifying costs, whereas for other retrofits it's 50%. And we required that the vehicles that the repowered engine is going to be put into have to have at least a 7-year useful life left in them, and that the old engine had to be scrapped. So all of those provisions were done to make sure that provision be more effective and also minimize the cost of it. Some other changes in Section 12 of the bill. We limited the total amount of the retrofit and repower tax credit to $3 million per year. In the original bill, there was no limit on the tax credit at all. And we clarified some confusing language the Department of Revenue was concerned about. in Section 3A of, under Section 12. So, in Section 16, we added a provision to prevent double counting. So if you're getting a tax credit, you first subtract out any public assistance you got in terms of grants before you can calculate the value of the tax credit. And we added a sunset date to this tax credit of December 2017, which is the same year that we set as the goal of meeting the target for the bill. In Section 10 and 12, we added some provisions about enforcement in response to a concern that we want to make sure if you give a tax credit or a grant that the people who receive those actually do the retrofit or the repower that, that we've paid for. And finally, in the new engine tax credit, we revised that so that only engines that meet the most recent federal standards would qualify. That those are for 2007 newer trucks. And we changed the annual cap on that tax credit from $3 million down to $500,000. So those were the major changes, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Broome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for this. What is the what are the teeth behind the enforcement of compliance portion of this? What's the teeth the department have? What are the teeth?
Okay.
Yeah.
When we provided a grant, Mr. Chair, Representative Broome, when we provided a grant or a tax credit, there would be there would be some conditions that would come with that in terms of scrapping in an engine, installing a retrofit, meeting other criteria like ensuring the vehicle has a 7-year useful life. And so the grantee or the taxpayer receiving the tax credit would commit to meeting those conditions. If they don't, then the Department of Revenue or Department of Environmental Quality could withdraw the tax credit. They would have to repay it. And we would also have all of the authorities we have for enforcement if that didn't occur in terms of civil penalties.
Okay, that was my follow-up question. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? And there was also the issue of continued maintenance of these cleanup devices. Is that addressed in the bill in some way? That was one of the issues that was raised under the enforcement rubric.
Chair Barnhart, my name is Kevin Downing. I work for the Department of Environmental Quality. That'll actually be addressed, actually not in the bill specifically, but in the conditions that we apply to the award of the tax credits and the grants.
So
we can ensure that there's continued maintenance and of the equipment.
And so I'll repeat the question that Representative Broome asked in connection with this issue. What are the teeth in case somebody takes a credit, installs the device, allows the device to fail? What happens?
Well, the conditions are similar to the language that we have now in terms of enforcing the conditions that the equipment is in place and continues to remain in place. That still applies as well. It will be under that authority, Chair.
And how about the operation of the equipment?
Again, that would be under we would be regarding that as being, the definition is that the device has to continue to operate in Oregon for a period of time, and we'll be looking at enforcement under that language.
And what is the enforcement?
As Chair Barnhart, as Andy described, it would be either what the bill allows us is to recover the cost of the tax credit or the grant, or to take action under our current civil penalty, with civil penalty as the ultimate enforcement.
Thank you. So it would likely be less expensive for somebody who became noncompliant to become compliant again rather than to deal with those penalties?
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. Our penalties include two elements. One is called economic benefits, so you always pay a penalty equal to the benefit you got from noncompliance. And then there may also be an additional penalty that would serve as a deterrent for other people to take similar types of violations. So that same structure would apply to this and any civil penalties we would apply.
And does the department have, or somebody, some agency have the capacity to do this kind of evaluation?
Mr. Chair, there's a companion policy package that goes with this bill, and so we are requesting a position in that package to oversee the implementation.
And then the last item that I have on this issue, this bill, is, as you know, the committee rules require that we state a purpose for a tax credit or a series of tax credits, and that we have a way of measuring whether or not that purpose has been met, and so that we can publish that in the tax expenditure report and ask the agencies that are responsible for it to answer the questions that we're using as measuring devices. And so that's the other subject. Could you address that one?
Yes, Mr. Chair. What's coming around to you now is a handout that shows how we'll measure achieving the goals of this bill. Section 2 of the bill sets the goal to reduce risk by the year 2017, and the bar chart on one side of that handout shows what that looks like in terms of risk, and then on the other side it shows in terms of translated into how many tons of emissions would have to be reduced. So we will, at the department, we'll be tracking the number of retrofits, repowers, idle reduction, and other steps that are taken under this bill to reduce emissions, calculating the emission reduction and tracking it until we get to the ultimate goal of 250 tons per year in the year 2017. And we've defined this as an agency performance measure, key performance measure, so we will be reporting on it each year as we come back to the legislature of the progress that we're making. And the Environmental Quality Commission, in developing implementing rules for Section 2, will provide more detail specifically about how we will do all that.
But these are things that you're going to report to the Ways and Means Committee anyway.
Correct.
So adding a report to us is simply a matter of making more copies. Thank
Correct.
You. Thank you. Does that generate other questions for people?
Mr. Chair,
yes, not
from that, but the fiscal impact statement that I'm looking at is dated March 9th, and I guess if this is going to Ways and Means, they're obviously going to be looking at that. But is there an updated fiscal impact that reflects these amendments, or is it still the same?
Well, I have a revenue impact of April 25th.
This might be. This says A engrossed, actually. So.
Yeah. April 25th one reflects the dash 5 amendments.
Right. Well, I don't. Ha- I don't. I must not be.
That's the revenue. The revenue impact. I don't. Uh-huh. Do you have a fiscal?
Oh no, not a fiscal.
We probably need a fiscal, don't we? On the dash 5s?
We do need one.
Yeah. Okay, what I'd like to do, if it's okay with the committee, is to allow some time for someone to hand engross this bill so we can. This is a fairly long amendment, and I'd at least like to have a chance to see how it fits all together. And while that's happening, we can get the fiscal, and because I don't believe this one does have a subsequent referral. I think this one goes to the floor. I'd like to get it right. And that gives us a chance to review the Dash 5 amendments, which I only got today. I think the committee did, too. And also get a fiscal on it, and that also may give you additional time in case you want to add any performance measures to the list that you've proposed. And do we have any idea how long it might take to get that?
To get the dash 5.
The fiscal?
I would have to check with the fiscal.
Okay. I think what we better do is close the work session on this bill, unless there's some more conversation about it now, and come back when we've got the fiscal. I'd hate to go to the floor without a fiscal on a bill like this. Thank you, Representative Brosnahan.
Yes. You were asking, Mr. Chair. You were asking for a hand engrossment.
Yes.
You're not going to move the. Okay.
I don't think there's any value in moving the amendment today until we understand exactly what it does.
I can walk through. I mean, we can.
And the problem is, we have 11, right. 10 bills left to go today,
which is why I didn't start off with that.
Right.
Because
okay.
I mean, I could walk through all the detail, but that would take.
Yeah.
Well, why don't?
Or maybe somebody could do that while we're hearing the other bills, and then we could come back to it.
Well, if we can get the, if we have a fiscal by then, we're not likely to have a fiscal by then, are we?
Yeah, I'll check. Okay. I'll check with LFL.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't think we have any choice. I think we have to wait. And hopefully we'll get it next week.
Girl's calling right now.
She's calling to find out.
She's calling this.
Okay. See if they've got one. All right, we're gonna close the work session.
Oh, we have.
We do have a fiscal.
Yay, Robin's turning
it down. Oh, okay. Well, then we'll wait.
Would you like me to walk through things?
Why don't you go ahead and walk through the amendment while we're waiting.
Okay.
Thank you. I know my mistake.
Okay, in walking through the Angros version of the bill, the first changes are made on page 2. After line 21, there's a definition of non-road. Going back and forth between the bill and then the dash 5 amendments. And so on page 2, after line 20, there's a definition of non-road Oregon diesel engine. Which means an Oregon diesel engine that was not designated primarily to propel a motor vehicle on public highways of this state. So that definition gets inserted. Then there's some subsequent renumbering. And then after line 27, there's a definition of public highway, which has the meaning given that term in ORS 825005. So again, just definitions. And then line 28, the definition of repower is modified so that it means to scrap an old diesel engine and replace it with a new engine, a used engine, or a remanufactured engine, or with electric motors, drives, or fuel cells with a minimum useful life of 7 years. So that just ensures that the replaced engine is scrapped and not resold somewhere else, and that the new version, if you will, has a useful life of at least 7 years. Then there is some more renumbering. And then after line 36, there is inserted a section 6A and a 6B. Now, this is a theme throughout the bill here. The credit sunsets at the end of 2017, and the way Ledge Council has drafted that is that there are companion sections for 6. You have a section 6 that references the credit, and then a 6A which does not reference the credit. So when the credit sunsets, the one section is just simply removed from the ORS. And so that's a theme through here. You'll see that there's a section 7A and 7B and 8A and 8B, and that's the reason for that. Okay, then moving on down on page 2, line 42, there's just a word change. Instead of includes the incremental cost, it now says may not exceed the incremental cost. So that's a word change. Moving on to page 3, after line 2, there's inserted a section 7A and 7B, similar to what I just described with section 6A and 6B. Moving down, again, still on page 3, line 4, after for the qualifying repower, the language now reads, for the qualifying repower of a non-road Oregon diesel engine or retrofit. I'm on page 3, line 4. So it just references the non-road Oregon diesel engines. So that language gets inserted. Line 10 on page 3 is deleted, which is simply the word and. And then on line 13, the period is deleted, inserted a semicolon and the word and. And then there's a new section C, which reads which is on page 4 of the dash amendments, and that new section C reads, a requirement that a qualifying repower or retrofit does not include the repower or retrofit of a vehicle or engine for which a grant or loan or tax credit under section 10 or 12 of this 2007 Act has been awarded or allowed, unless the repower or retrofit will reduce emissions further than the repower or retrofit grant funded by the grant, loan, or tax credit. And again, that's the language for the section 8. And then the 8A has the reference to the tax credit removed. Continuing on page 3, line 28, grants and loans to the owners and operators rather than or. And on line 29, the reference to repowers is removed. And then on page, then after line 30, there's a new section B. which reads grants and loans to the owners and operators of non-road Oregon diesel engines for up to 25% of the certified costs of qualifying repowers as described in Section 7 and 8. So that just limits the cost, as the folks from DEQ were saying, for up to 25% of the certified costs. I mean, limits the grants and loans up to 25% of the costs. Then there's a renumbering on line 31. And then on page 3, lines 32 through 34 are deleted. So the language of the department may not award a grant or loan for qualifying repower or retrofit under Section 1A of this section if, after payment of taxes on the grant or loan, the net amount exceeds the incremental cost of a qualifying repower or retrofit. That language is simply removed. Then on page 4, there are some section references that are changed. And then after line 19, there is a new subsection 7, which reads, the department may perform activities necessary to ensure that the recipients of grants and loans from the Clean Diesel Engine Fund comply with the applicable requirements. If the department determines that a recipient has not complied with the applicable requirements, it may order the recipient to refund all grant or loan monies and may impose penalties pursuant to ORS 468-140, and that was discussed by DEQ. Line 27, the end of that line, the word vehicle is replaced with engine. Section 12, there's a reworking. Now, this is where we get into the credit. And there's a reworking of this language so that on starting with line 31 refers to the certified cost of a repower of a non-road engine, non-road diesel engine, or a retrofit of an Oregon diesel engine that occurs after the effective date of this act. Line 32 and 33 now reads, the repower or retrofit has been identified as qualifying for the credit under rules adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission under Section 8 of this 2007 Act. Line 34, stop, it now reads, the engine will constitute an Oregon diesel engine and, then moving down to line 36, subsection C is unchanged. And then subsection 2, the maximum amount of the tax credit allowed under this section is limited to the amount of the tax credit allowed under the tax credit. The maximum of the credit is limited to 25% of the certified cost of each qualifying repower and 50% of the certified cost of each qualifying retrofit. So that's limiting the amount of the credit depending on whether it's a repower or retrofit. And then subsection 3 is modified so that the amount of the tax credit allowed to the taxpayer under this section in any one tax year may not exceed the tax liability of the taxpayer for the tax year. Lines 43 through 45 are deleted. That is the language that the Department of Revenue had concerns about. It wasn't very clear. And that had to do with the limitations on the credit, so that's just replaced by the two limitations that I just mentioned.
That's on where?
Page 4, lines 43 through 45.
I'm confused now because I thought we deleted that already. Oh, I guess I'm in the wrong place, huh? Okay.
Yeah, this was the language that it originally said may not exceed 50% of the taxpayer's tax liability for the tax year after application of all other tax credits. And it was a very confusing language, and the Department of Revenue suggested that it be removed and simply replaced with language that limited the credit to no more than the liability of the taxpayer.
Okay,
then moving on to page 5, line 19. Now reads, was destroyed by arson committed by the taxpayer, or if the engine no longer meets the requirements for obtaining the tax credit. That was also mentioned by DEQ. That was that language that pertains to maintaining the engine. After line 24, there's a new subsection C that reads, the department may perform activities necessary to ensure that recipients of the tax credit comply with applicable requirements. And that refers to the Department of Revenue and in terms of granting the credit. And then in subsection 9, starting on line 41 on page 5, the ORS references in 43 and 45 originally referred to the RETC credit. That's the 316.116 or 317.115. and that has been changed to statutes 469.185 to 469.225, which is the Betsy credit. And this simply allows a taxpayer who's claiming the credit for the repower or retrofits also use the Betsy credit, so it doesn't limit that credit.
I guess I was confused because the amendment actually says that Section 12 is deleted. That is lines 29 through 45 on page 5, page 6, and line 1 on page 6, which is Section 12. And then it writes a new Section 12, which I take it from what you said is essentially identical, except for the things that you've indicated are different.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Now I understand.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have pointed that out going into
thank
it.
Thank you. I'm trying to follow along as we do this, and that one got me confused. Thank you. Go ahead.
Then moving on to page 6, line 1 is deleted as part of that, what we just talked about. Then on line 18, 2007 is changed to 2008, and that pertains to the effective date for the credit certifications, and that was changed. It was pushed back a year so that the department could put together administrative rules pertaining to the credit, and this gives them the time to do that, and then issue the credit certificates. Prior, there was a timing problem in that the certificates could be issued, yet the administrative rules had not been written.
Okay.
Then moving on to page 7, line 6. No, I just got myself lost.
Okay. Line 10 on page 8 of the amendment.
Yes. There we go. Yeah, lines 10 through 15 on page 8 of the amendments. So that's inserted in the paragraph, and it's the language in determining the amount of the tax credit under this section. The department shall reduce the incremental cost of a qualifying repower retrofit by the value of any existing financial incentive that directly reduces the cost of the qualifying repower retrofit, including tax credits, grants, loans, or any other public financial assistance. That just avoids a kind of double dipping, if you will.
Right. And that was related to the Department of Revenue's concerns, I assume.
I don't remember who brought up the concern, but in terms of identifying the qualified cost,
okay,
it's just reduced by costs that weren't borne by the taxpayer. It just adjusts for that. And then after line 15, there's a 16A, which simply repeals the credit. That's the language that actually repeals the credit. And when that happens, those sections that refer to the credit are simply removed from the statutes.
Hence the double language.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then the only other changes on line 7, or page 7, line 25, it originally had the January 1, 2004 date pertaining to the diesel engine. It required that diesel engines purchased after January 1, 2004, and that has been modified to the effective date of this act, so that only engines purchased after the effective date of this act qualify for the new purchase credit. And then there's language pertaining to the federal standards. On lines 26, the oxides of nitrogen is replaced with particulate matter, and the rate, instead of 2.5 grams per brake horsepower hour, is 0.01. And so that pertains to the federal standards. And then the last change on page 9, lines 5 and line 7, those dollar amounts, the $3 million, that was what was in existing law pertaining to the annual credit limit for the purchase of diesel engines. That has been reduced to $500,000. So for the credit that for which the bill extends the sunset, the annual limit is reduced from $3 million to $500,000.
Okay. Any questions about the steps that we've gone through? We do have a fiscal that was prepared in connection with the A engrossed version. That is before the -5 amendments. I wonder if the department has anything to add to that. I guess the question is, do the Dash 5 amendments change your view of what the fiscal ought to be?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Andy Ginsberg with the Department of Environmental Quality. No, I don't think that the Dash 5 changes the fiscal. It only affects the tax credits, and so, as we've discussed, the fiscal impact would be the same.
Thank you. And thank you very much. Questions? Chris, why don't you talk a little bit about the income cost to us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the revenue impact statement that you have before you shows an impact in the 07-09 biennium of $1.9 million, and then in 09-11 an impact of $4.4 million. And there are two pieces to that revenue impact: the extension of the sunset for the existing credit, and that has been costing the state $200,000 or $300,000 a year, so that just gets extended starting in 08 and moving forward. And then the new credit, which is limited to $3 million per year, is assumed to phase in over a few years. So there's only a portion of it used in 08 and then a little more in 09. That basically assumes that there isn't all this pent-up demand, that their $3 million in credits will be issued right out the gate, and at the program there will be some take-up time.
I think we'll hear from the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, on page 8 of the Dash A5 amendment, lines 7 and 8, refer to the $3 million that staff just mentioned. And I think what was intended here was that the Department of Environmental Quality would not certify more than $3 million worth of credits in a calendar year. My best reading of the language is that it could mean that the department, in processing returns, would track them, and when we hit $3 million in a calendar year, we would not allow any more credits. I don't believe that's what was intended by the sponsors of the amendment. So I simply wanted to get that on the record, and if you'd prefer to correct that on the Senate side, we'd have no problem with it.
Okay. So
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
See, this is kind of a minor fix.
I think it's very correctable, but I think if it's not corrected, we're likely going to be advised by our attorneys that we need to track it and stop granting. The problem would be that if DEQ certifies $3 million in the first year and a taxpayer can't take all of it in the next year, even though someone has a certificate, they're going to be denied it once we hit $3
million. Okay.
Thank you, Mr.
And
Chair.
It's your understanding that that the point of the bill is, and what the other department wants, I probably should ask them this, is that that they want the authority to allow $3 million a year of certificates, and that when those are allowed, that the Department of Revenue allows them on the tax return.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that we would honor whatever certificate and credit is claimed on the return. It would be the other agency's responsibility to stop issuing when the cap in the law had been reached.
Right. And your understanding is that this language doesn't allow that.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? All right. Well, we've been working on this for quite a while. Let me ask one more question of the Revenue Department. This credit...
DEQ.
I'm sorry. DEQ, yes, that's what I meant. this credit is contemplated in the governor's budget, is it?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. That may be why we don't have the direct referral to Ways and Means. I do have a note from Bob Russell, who indicates that it's his understanding that there is expected to be a Ways and Means referral after the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee has heard the bill. So that means we have to get it to them in order to do it. Committee, what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would be happy to make a motion.
Please.
To move it forward. Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2172A.
Representative Gelser moves the A5 amendments to House Bill 2172. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the amendment? Without objection, the amendment is adopted. Representative Gelser?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2172A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gelser moves House Bill 2172A as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I would simply say that one of the things I'm looking forward to is cleaner air in the Willamette Valley, especially the Upper Valley, and I think that this bill helps us move along in that direction, and I appreciate the fact that it's been brought for that purpose. If there's no further discussion, please call the roll.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Excused.
Representative Yelsey.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Baltimore.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Aye. The motion having required the, achieved the required majority is declared adopted, and the bill will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Reed has asked to carry the bill. I think that we also may want to have Representative Butler on this bill. So why don't the two of you carry it together, unless he's not here, I can't ask him, but if he doesn't want to, then you'll carry it alone.
That's fine. Thank
is that
you.
All right? Sure. Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2172. And we'll open a work session on House Bill 2691. I don't think I have an amendment, do I?
I know. I appreciate
you hearing that.
2691. Okay. Mazin? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for House Bill 2692, we've also been working on...
91?
Right. 92 is not to be heard today.
Shall not be mentioned.
Just wanted to
repeat that.
Enliven, yes.
2691, Mr. Chair, just to refresh you, Lily and the committee, this is the bill that we started talking about at the beginning of the session. This is the bill that gives allowance and allowable language for the counties to collect and kind of put in place their ability to levy registration fees on vehicles. And the need for that came, just to remind you, with the problems that started looming on the horizon with the federal receipts. For the forest receipts and the road funds for many of the counties, and this was a proposal to allow them to have their own registration fees on the vehicles that reside in the county. But during this journey that we took with this bill, Mr. Chair, we tried to amend the language that exists today. And the first amendments that we had, the ones and the two, basically allowed for the amount to go to be double the level that exists today for the state, which is $27 a year or $54 a biennium. So we would be allowing them $54 a year at that. And then, of course, the second amendment that came, and it's also enclosed in both the -6s and the -7 that you have in front of you, is to allow the counties to do that by a vote of their governing body without having to go for a vote from the county residents at that time. Now, several things have been worked with in the -6s and in the -7s. The difference, what I've mentioned so far, is included in the both of the sets of the amendments, the -6 and the -7. However, the -6 and the -7s are different in a sense that they are trying to work through some intricate details that come from the past that have built through the time what is termed as by the county people who look at this as what do you call it, BJ? The web?
Spider web,
right. The spider web of connections between counties, metro, especially for as a taxing district, and the cities and the agreements between them and so on. And I believe that because that wasn't necessarily the complete satisfaction of everybody that have been talked to with this, that's why the two sets of amendments to allow whether to untangle the spider web or just leave it in place and allow for the ability to levy the new vehicle registration fee. A lot of the stuff that you see in the back with the schedules of the weight mile, registration by weight for the heavy vehicles, these are all changes. You see that the what needed to be done is within those sections of the law, there was or needed to have an insertion of the new amendments, the 803.445, and that it has to be mentioned within that structure in order for them to be allowed to do it. And this is something that you can find on page 14 on line 5 of the dash 6 amendments. This is, for example, where you would find those changes. The one thing that is still probably you would want to discuss, and you said that you might, Mr. Chair, and other interested and members of the committee, is whether we go with the two or with the three multiples of the vehicle registration as it exists in the state system now. This is on page 13 of the dash 6. What happened is through the multiple iterations of amendments, if you will, we started with three, or two and three, and those were just to allow them to go up to two times, but the total would be three times.
13.
Page 13. And this is at the top of the page where you have the subsection 5 and the subsection 6. However, with time, I think with the amendment, excuse me, that three multiples are probably not needed. It's just it might be an allowance that you want to leave there, or you could go down to a two. It's probably a discussion that this work session could talk about, and you could also discuss it with the representative from the different counties. I asked them to address you with their understanding and how they've been working with it, because it's been quite a lot of work behind the scenes.
Okay.
And the dash sixes and dash sevens are the latest of that work.
So just to make sure I understand, dash six actually makes some other changes in addition to the ones the dash seven makes.
It's the other way around.
And you better tell us again what those are, because
yeah.
I don't understand.
Yeah.
Yes. Representative Berger?
Yeah, I don't understand the difference between the dash 6 and the dash 7.
Yes, thank you. I agree.
Well, besides...
The
spider web.
Where is
the spider web?
My daughters would say, itsy bitsy spider.
Yes.
That's what itsy bitsy though.
I think we could probably benefit, Mr. Chair, from a discussion with our county.
With the county drafters? Is there someone here from the county who would like to help us with this.
And, Mr. Chair, may I ask a question while...
Yes, please.
On the, I'm looking in dash 6 on page 13, the subsection 6 that explains how credit of the dash 6 amendments.
Yeah.
I think it's probably true in the original bill and the other amendments, too, but just a sort of mechanical question. When it talks about the credit that's available if the fees exceed the amount, would the credit then come from what the state is getting or the county? Where would that credit come from?
The credit, Vice Chair Reed, would not be a refund. It would be a credit against the total. So what this says is you're guaranteed not to pay above this. However, if let's say a county has two or three multiples and then another jurisdiction, let's say Metro, has the same thing, you get credit proportional to the amounts, and therefore you only pay that ceiling.
That's what I was looking for. Thank you.
But the state would get its registration no matter what.
Registration shared no matter what.
All
right. Thank you.
And then, okay. And then there's a fight on it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mazin, you asked for help, so...
BJN.
I guess we're interested in the spider web.
It's BJ's long project.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm BJ Smith. I'm with Clackamas County as the Public Relations and Government Relations Director. I'll also tell you that in 1989, when the spider web was actually created, I was working with the League of Oregon Cities. And unfortunately, this is something that I helped make.
Uh-oh.
And I know. It really is an interesting situation to be back now, many years later, and saying nobody's ever really figured out how it worked. But let me try to explain. This is something that was specifically put in for the Portland metropolitan area many years ago. And it is a process. I've tried to explain it here. It is in sub 7, by the way. Section 1, sub 7 of the bill is where you find the reference to kind of changing the spider web. And what the spider web did is that if you were a county in the Portland metropolitan area and you had presumably a couple of overlapping transportation districts, which would be TriMet and Metro, and you had also other counties that were underneath those overlapping transportation districts, such as Multnomah and Washington, that you had to have an agreement among all parties before any individual county could do a local option vehicle registration fee. Now, the provisions of the current statute say that that agreement must state what the fee would be, and if you decided to share money with any of those, it doesn't say that you must, but if you did, then it would be stated in the agreement. There's also another obligation on a county that would be engaged in bringing forward a local vehicle registration fee, and that's to deal with the cities within the county. And there is a minimum standard there that the cities would receive 40% of the revenue unless agreed otherwise. Then there is a sequence of steps that a county would have to go through. And the first part of the sequence is that they would meet with their counties and decide, or with their cities, and decide if we go to a 40% allocation to cities or an agreed otherwise allocation. Could be project list or something like that. After you finish that step, then you would go into the process of trying to make an agreement that doesn't really say you must have a substantive term in it with your two neighboring counties and two other overlapping transportation districts. And if, in the course of that secondary discussion, something changed, you would go back and consult again with your city. So the problem is that you continue to never really get to your end result. So what we're trying to do here is...
Just so I understand, that's the existing
that's
subset.
That's the existing law. That's the spider web. That's
now,
the description.
Now go ahead and talk about what you propose.
And what we would like to do now is just somewhat streamline this. The first correction really in here is that the county would be obligated 90 days before it would even consider an enactment to bring everybody together. That would be the cities within the county, as well as the overlapping transportation districts and the other counties, because the conversation really is much broader than just one group or the other group or sequencing. We would be obligated also under this proposal to have a public hearing, so there'd be notification to everybody who was in the spider web. We would be obligated to have a public hearing, and from that we would draw out the intergovernmental agreements that might be necessary. Many of you would probably be surprised if Clackamas County, for instance, were to raise a vehicle registration fee and wanted to spend it entirely in Multnomah and Washington County. That's probably not the point of asking residents in Clackamas County to do that. But there would be the authorization to have intergovernmental agreements if that were necessary. There is absolutely no change in the situation with respect to cities within the county. There would be a share based on formula or an agreed otherwise. So it's a simplification, but it's also a consolidation of the effort to get everybody in the room at one time. And so that's it. And, oh, I wanted to mention, Mr. Chair, you know, this is probably doesn't raise up to the level of high priority on a lot of other local governments' lists, but I did distribute to our Metro Lobby copies of the proposals to kind of de-web the spider web a little bit, but not eliminate our overlapping discussions. And as far as I know, I've checked with Gresham, Portland, Washington County, Multnomah County. Metro said it didn't raise to the level of making a decision. They see good points and bad points, but in the end, we all end up having to discuss with one another in the metropolitan area in order to make this happen. And I certainly know that to the extent that Clackamas County would consider anything like this, that I have a commissioner that testified on a similar bill who jokingly representative said, I know Clackamas County's processes, and these will probably go on for a year or more. Mm-hmm. And she said, yes, that's probably the case. That would be a very full, open, transparent process for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Let me ask one. The only difference then between these two drafts is this issue that you've raised.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Exactly.
And what this does, if I understand it, is it reduces the number of steps and implodes several conversations into one.
That's correct. And it makes mandatory agreements that do not have a specific outcome in the statute. It makes them just voluntary agreements. So if there is an agreement requirement here, but it doesn't tell you what you must agree to.
All right. And so the adjustment, in the event of that there's no agreement, the adjustment is made in the statute under the credit section, in effect.
If there were overlapping, if the overlapping transportation districts did impose, then it automatically happens under the statute that the credit section takes care
right.
of that.
So everyone will take account of that as they act as bulls in the china shop or
right.
or decide to cooperate.
Right.
Thank you. Anything else?
Yeah.
Representative Berger.
So the spider web, go back to 6 and 7. Mm-hmm. The spider web that you described is in 6.
Mr. Chair,
and
Representative
7
Berger,
does
that's
it
correct.
A different way and,
right.
and sort of de-webs some of
right.
it.
And the sole reason for the fact that I asked Mazen to do it that way is because I wanted to touch base with all of our fellow jurisdictions in the metropolitan area, give them an opportunity to raise their hand up if they really had serious concerns about moving forward. So at the time we authorized the amendments, we did not have as much feedback as I have today.
And they...
Let me say it again, just to be certain that we all understand so that I understand. Mm-hmm. If I've got... I'm open to page 3 in both amendments. Mm-hmm. And on page 3 in the dash 7 amendments, I see only a very minor change on the mm-hmm. sub-7 section where we change a verb from plural to singular. I don't see any other change. That's the spider web, isn't
that
it?
That is the spider web.
All right, in the dash 6 amendments... There is a considerable change. Most of that language is repealed, and we actually add a bunch of new language, which extends over onto page 4. And that's the language that you're speaking to now.
That would be the substitute.
So you're proposing, I think, that the dash 6 amendment,
yes.
Because in all other respects, the two amendments are the same.
That is correct, Mr.
Thank,
Chair.
Thank you. Does that help, Representative Berger?
Yes, it does, Mr. Chair, because, The dash six looks like more of a spider web to me, but if she assures me that it's the other way around, no. I believe her, since she designed the spider web. I wouldn't put that on my resume.
Tangled up local government even more.
Yes,
a superhero.
They do. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I'm Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties, and just wanted to again say why this bill is important to counties at this point. If you recall, the state can raise a registration fee, and you do that as a legislative matter. And if the citizens don't like it, they refer it. The cities in the state of Oregon can also raise gas tax and registration, and again, if by legislation, and again, if there is a problem in the local community, they can refer that to a vote. Where we are with the counties, we're different. Counties, based on current statutes, if they look at raising a gas tax, or if they look at, as we're here, looking at the opportunity to do a local registration, we have to refer it to the voters first before it can be implemented. And what we're asking here is a very simple thing, is for the counties at this point to be treated the same as the state and the same as the cities, to give the counties the opportunity, if they find it desirable and warranted, to do a local registration fee in conjunction with the cities at this point, because you've heard about how those funds are shared, and also go to the people, because we have to do this through an ordinance, so there's public hearings in these things, and make your case, put the fee into effect, and then if there's still angst after all of that, then somebody can refer that to a vote of the people. That's the way the system. So we're asking to be treated the same. The other thing I would point to you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I saw some people had the county, some of the county information, and I just gave you another copy of the impact to counties of PL 106-393. And if you look in the far right-hand column, the three columns on the right deal with roads, and you can see the percent in the far right hand column, you can see the percentage of loss that counties will face if PL 106-393 is not reauthorized. It amounts to in excess of $90 million annually. So we're looking at least either immediately or in the very near future, because the discussions are maybe you might get 1 year, or you might get maybe up to 5 years of additional assistance from the federal government, a ramp down to the point where we're probably not going to see any of those funds coming to counties to help maintain the road systems that we have at this point. And I just did a quick check, and there are 14 counties that at this point would lose more than a third of their current road fund budget, more than a third. And some of those, as you can see, are up to 50, 60, 70% at this point. It varies based on the amount of federal land, but this is something that is very serious. And, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is all we're asking, all the counties are asking at this point, is give us another tool that we can put in the toolbox so that we might be able to help ourselves address some of these issues. And I think the registration fee is probably the most realistic fee in terms of transportation that a county could do. Because if you look to gas tax, number one, that's quite volatile subject, needless to say, with the price of gas. And the industry doesn't like local gas taxes. They really don't like those from the standpoint it balkanizes the situation. And they, of themselves, let alone the citizens, being angst about the local gas tax, the industry goes out and gets votes to refer those. So I would just submit this is probably the most realistic opportunity that the counties will have to raise some road funds in the very near future if they decide to go that. And it's at this point, it's entirely optional. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'll step back off my soapbox. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to address those.
Thank you. Representative Berger?
Yeah, thank you. Art, let's go back to the beginning of your remarks. You said that the state do whatever they want, which we know. We're sitting here doing whatever we want. And we love what we're doing. I'm sorry, but this is the poor me part of the speech. And then you said, but the counties can't impose these fees, but the cities can, and you said, do something, and I said, they can do what? They could impose a gas tax.
Yes.
But they can't impose these kinds of fees. Registration fees. How?
Right, that's correct.
Okay. Know of any cities that have got gas tax enacted?
Yes, and we know some that are under.
Which ones?
City of Tigard.
Tigard
just recently did one.
Eugene.
And Eugene does one?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There's a number of, and I can get you that information.
And they impose them as city gas tax?
That's correct.
Okay. Is there anything in here, your argument about the loss of PL 106393 is very compelling, of course. I mean, I'm not, but is there anything in here, Mazin, that says that these fees are only for counties that are impacted? So any county, if we pass this, any county can do this, irregardless of what the impacts of this are.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that's correct. This would be open to any county. Again, it's optional, and you're going to have to look at your needs, and you're going to have to talk to the cities in terms of how this all comes together.
Spiderweb.
I would submit to you Lane County. If they look at doing this, they're going to have to sit down with Springfield, Eugene, and all the other cities, because if there's not community support and they go to hearings, they're not going to be successful. And you don't do this. I mean, you wouldn't go down this road or this trail to do a local registration fee with the idea, and not want to be successful. There is not, at this point, in the state of Oregon, a local registration fee. And to my knowledge, one county tried that a number of years ago, and it didn't go anyplace. About six, well, more than that, I think it was in 1990, and I'm going to say seven or eight, about eight counties proposed county gas tax, and they all went down at the ballot initially. So you can see the difficulty trying to do local revenue that we have.
We would need a fairly compelling, the county commission would have to make a fairly compelling case.
Yes.
In order to get it.
Yes.
Yeah. Representative Berger?
Yeah. Every county's different, as you say. I'm very wary of this blanket without having something in here about voter approval. Just put it on the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just to get back to Representative Berger, there's about nine cities, Representative, who levy gas taxes.
And they are enacted.
They are at different levels. Some of them are half a penny, some of them 1 penny. Some are very easy to collect because of one gas station in the whole city.
Right.
I think Eugene is a nickel, isn't it?
Eugene is actually 2 pennies.
2 cents? Yeah. Okay.
Eugene and Springfield has it.
It's a nickel. That's what I thought. It is a nickel.
A nickel. Yeah. Eugene could get away with that, Mr. Chair.
Right. Okay. Yes. Well, it does distort because Eugene isn't very large, and it's easy to drive into the county or to Springfield to buy gasoline for those who want to do that.
Yeah. Some do it on a sunset type of.
In your view, is this bill ready to move?
Mr. Chair,
you've prepared the amendments. Are you happy with them?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to just and partly because of Representative Berger, I am going to identify one issue that I believe your legislative staff addressed that we would like to some feedback on. And once that issue is addressed, I would say this bill is ready.
Okay.
And the issue, Mr. Chair, is the multiplier. The current law would allow a local government to do a local registration fee equal to what the state has. Okay. The discussion has been, and you started this discussion before even I was at the table at this point, as to whether the local government should have an opportunity to raise it, let's say, twice as much as what the state has, or three times as much as what the state has, okay? And the state currently is at $27. So, the policy decision that you have, or we would like to have you discuss and give some feedback, is, are you comfortable with three? Are you comfortable with two? Or are you more comfortable with one, which is just a match? And once that, you know, and I don't want to, I just want to put that on the table at this point. Once you come to agreement as a committee on that, I think the bill is ready to go. And right now in the bill, there is three.
Mm-hmm.
If you're more comfortable with two, I'm comfortable with two. If you're, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if you're more comfortable with one, I'm more comfortable with one, because the important thing here is to give the counties the tool.
All right. Representative Berger.
I didn't realize it was $27. Why did I think that it was different?
It was different, Representative, and it was changed. This is part of OTA3, which is not too long ago. It was changed.
And what is it now?
It's $27 a year, which makes it $54.
I'm thinking biennium. I'm going, I was over $50. Okay. Yeah. You're talking year, we're talking biennium.
And
thank
course,
you. I'm going,
new,
whoa.
New vehicles, Representative. New vehicles could register for 40.
Okay.
So if it comes over $100, then.
Yeah. And this language says.
Yeah, I think that what you're saying is that you'd like some additional time
here
to prepare additional information for the committees about the different steps, once, twice, or three times,
okay. And
a chance to discuss whether or not those would be acceptable. And I take it from what you've just said, too, that the issue of the required plebiscite is an important one to the counties.
Mr. Chair, B.J. Smith with Clackamas County, I also wanted to tell you that I think I've had conversations with DMV, and they caught a small error that was in one of the earlier drafts. I wanted to say that as far as I know, the change to the spider web is ready to go, and the DMV has looked at the collection agreement that we need to have with them, and I think we're fine there. But just kind of a secondary statement, I think oftentimes people think of Clackamas County as a metropolitan county. We're both metropolitan and rural, and we are also a county that's affected by secure rural schools to the tune of, given the year that you do the percentages on, is between 16 and, say, 20 or 22% of our road fund. So hopefully, I know I have a commission that's interested in self-help tools in the near future for the situation that we're facing on our roads.
Thank you. I think, committee, that we're not ready to work the bill today, and we ought to close the, unless someone strongly disagrees with that, I think we ought to close the hearing and have a work session and allow for continued conversation and perhaps the preparation of another amendment depending upon what the results of those conversations are. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2691. And where am I? We have two carryover issues from last night. One of them we actually held a public hearing on last night. The other one we did not. We actually held a public hearing on the issue of the roll your own tobacco and that's House Bill 3454. Is there anyone else here who wants to be heard on House Bill 3454? who wasn't here last night. I don't see anybody. So we're going to open the work session on House Bill 3454. 34, Mazin, that's one of your bills.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
House Bill 3454, Mr. Chair, we heard the discussion about it yesterday when the Attorney General came and not the Attorney, but the Deputy. They told us how this bill basically is a requirement that they feel that is needed within the statutes in order to complete the enforcement issues that have to be done as part of the Master Settlement Agreement. The Master Settlement Agreement is with the tobacco companies, by also which stipulates that there needs a certain level of enforcement that the states need to do in order for the Master Settlement Agreements to continue coming in unhindered. That's where these new clarifications, if you will, they term it as in the law, is needed at this time. And you have the Mr. Chair, the testimony yesterday from Lisa Adland, the Assistant Attorney General, and basically just specifies those same issues that we mentioned.
Right, thank you. This is a very simple bill. I think the only change in the statute is on the second page, where we added the term roll your own tobacco container or on, and then omitted or roll your own tobacco containers. The point is that in Oregon we do not put a tax stamp on the roll your own tobacco, and so the language in the old law would allow only roll your own tobacco containers with a tax stamp to be considered. This just moves the modifier so it can be applied even though they don't have a tax stamp. Have I got that right?
Yeah,
I'm getting a nod. So it's a very small change, but it's important to in order to maintain our position in the very large national tobacco settlement. Committee, what's your pleasure? Do I have a motion?
I'll move, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Berger.
I move House Bill 3454 to the floor. Will they do pass, or does this...
Yes.
Is there no subsequent referral? Yep.
I don't think so.
I move House Bill 3454 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves House Bill 3454 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? If not, please call the roll.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Excused.
Representative
Helfer. Aye.
Representative Yes.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. The bill, having received the required majority, is adopted, and the motion is adopted, and the bill will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any reason why this one should not go on the consent calendar? All right. I don't hear any objections to that, so we'll put this one on the consent calendar. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3454. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3537. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3537 exempts from taxation and real personal property of retail stores owned by a nonprofit entity if the retail stores deal exclusively in donated inventory and then the proceeds from the store's sales are used to financially support a not-for-profit housing program. Under current law, there are quite a few retail stores that deal with that are nonprofits. They do deal with donated inventory, and all of them, let's say, donate the sales from the proceeds from their sales to welfare programs, none of which are
not-for-profit housing programs. This is a glitch, but and it's a very small number, but it could actually increase. I put a revenue impact together based on a survey that the Department of Revenue did for me. All but, I believe, six counties responded, and so the revenue impacts that I've given you are what the tax losses would be for the entities that are currently not-for-profit retail stores that deal with housing programs, not-for-profit housing programs. The housing programs would be such that the proceeds are donated and it helps to build homes that are sold at the low cost or at relatively low cost to qualified people. The impacts, of course, do not adjust for any behavioral changes, and there are quite a few out there that might increase the impact of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I've been down here too long. Mary, these are real numbers, not in thousands or millions.
Right.
They're just real, honest to goodness, 11,567 and 22,453.
Those are the dollars.
Okay, thank you. I'm so used to in thousands, in millions.
We're not used to seeing dollars written by
I'm not. I just
you
had to make sure that document. I wasn't missing something here, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Breathing, isn't it?
Other comments on Mary's report? Thank you. We have signed up today Wanda Kinney, and it looks like Cindy Mitchell. Please come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Wanda Kinney. I'm the executive director of the Albany Area Habitat for Humanity that serves in Linn County. We just wanted to have the opportunity to give you some background about our affiliates and what happens in the state of Oregon with habitat. Often we build on pieces of property that are very unloved. We bring property taxes into our counties. We our restores a few years ago. I think we've had restores across the nation in habitat for a long time. But in Oregon, I believe we've had them for the last 10 years. In Albany, we've had ours for 6 years. Our stores bring revenue that's directly used towards our mission to build homes in partnership with low-income families. Our stores are also an avenue for disabled services for people who need job training, our local community colleges and universities are able to have individuals work in our stores on a volunteer basis to get job training to get back into the workforce. We work with veterans programs, community service programs. So our stores not only provide a direct related mission to our habitat mission, which is to build homes, but they also are a community involved organization of our retail stores. We typically affiliates serve HUD median income families that are in the 25% to 60% income range. We build our homes with donations, profits from our stores, gift in kind donations, and we sell them to our homeowners with zero interest loans at no profit to our organizations.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thanks for your attention to this really critical issue for Habitat for Humanity. I'm Cynthia Mitchell, and I'm Executive Director of Benton County Habitat for Humanity. And I think Wanda's pretty much covered everything, except that I want to remind you that this is truly a three-in-one meal deal. Benton Habitat alone has just had a restore, we call them, which is a used building material store. We accept donations of used toilets, sinks, any type of building materials, and this this quote tool time atmosphere is pretty amazing because it gives us the opportunity to partner senior citizens, and in Benton County we have a lot of really knowledgeable senior citizens with at-risk county mandated youth, and in a mentoring type program where they have all kinds of ever-changing inventory as the donations come in, learn to do repair, learn to graft the volunteer hours. Fenton County alone at our store has diverted 267 tons from the Coffin Butte landfill. So that alone is creating quite an impact on our community. The last thing I wanted to mention is the impact that it has on the explosion of volunteers that's happened. As you know, people are terribly disillusioned, and this provides an opportunity to really build hope, particularly for our young people. And we tire them out by having them lift all those big, heavy things, and it does create long-term sustainability. For when I came on, we were in the ditch financially, and this has enabled us to get a system going that's going to keep us going for a long time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Gelser.
Mr. Speaker, thank you for indulging me for a moment, but I just wanted to commend Habitat for Humanity for the tremendous creativity and spirit that it brings to our communities in Benton County. We've seen some very exciting things over the last couple of years with cooperation between the city and Habitat and local citizens. We had the opportunity to have an annexation of property where we're going to build a large number of affordable housing units thanks to the generosity of a donor who we actually have a celebration of his life tomorrow. We recently lost him and wanted to acknowledge that at this point, and just the exciting things that Habitat for Humanity can do and the ways that it brings people together through its many efforts beyond just building the houses.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments, Sarah.
Thank you very much. I hadn't heard therapy for youth put quite so bluntly before, but I like it.
Yeah.
Anyone who is tired out from a hard day's work is not going to be causing trouble at night.
Right. We're also getting very creative, and we have abundance of youth bifold doors that are being donated and paint, and that's now being partnered together as free art materials for our schools. So any nonprofit can come and get free paint and bifold doors, and they're making some really elaborate screens as art projects. We can't keep them in stock anymore.
I take it that this bill would reduce your property tax
yes.
costs, and that to that extent would benefit the program.
Correct.
You didn't actually say that, but I'm assuming that that's the case.
Correct.
Thank you for the assumption.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much.
You.
We have Representative Wisnant here who would like to be heard.
Oh, that's great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, committee. Short and to the point. My name is Gene Wisden. I'm State Representative, District 53, and I was asked to present this or to introduce this bill, and I'm proud to do it. I think you just heard some great testimony. I've been a big supporter of Habitat for Humanity. I've done some mailing and contributed to them, and I think it's a good bill. I hope you'll pass it.
Thank you. Questions?
Representative, I'm just curious how many times the representative has gone out and helped with a hammer.
Only one time.
That was enough, huh?
No, that was scheduling problems. Every time we'd want to go back, it'd either be raining in Sun River, which doesn't happen much. Or, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative, for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 3537? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3537, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 3537. Committee, what's your pleasure?
Do you want a motion, Mr. Chair?
Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3537 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves House Bill 3537 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
If I could.
Yes, please.
Good bill should pass.
That's short.
No, affirmative.
Okay. All right. Call the roll.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Grimm.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Excused.
Representative
Olson.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative
Grimm. Aye.
And Chair Blackheart.
Chair votes aye. And with that, the motion carries, and House Bill 3537 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Should this go on the consent calendar? Should we ask Representative Wisnant to carry it?
I think Wisnant would love to
carry it. I think he would. Let's have him carry the bill. And with that, we'll close the work session. Okay. We're in time now for our first public hearing on House Bill 3478 and House Bill 3548. We'll open those now. Are those yours, Mary?
Yes, they are.
Yep, go ahead.
House Bill 3478 adds dairy processors to the list of qualified companies that are eligible for a five-year property tax exemption on their purchases of new machinery and equipment. It applies to tax years beginning on or after July 1, 2007. Under current law, some of you might recall that in the 2005 session, this particular bill came up, and it exempted several food processors. Those processors processors dealt with nuts and legumes and other types of goods. I don't think I have it here. But at any rate, you have the SMS before you that describes what they did, the current law actually exempts. I don't have a copy in my folder. And the related bill, that's 3548, extends that exemption to include dairy processors and egg processors. And that's, again, similar law. The background is that the five-year property tax exemption was granted to qualified companies that purchased new equipment, and this SMS that I have states clearly that the qualified companies must be engaged currently in the business of freezing, canning, dehydrating, concentrating, preserving, processing, or repacking vegetables, fruits, legumes, nuts, or seafood. So the first 3537 deals with dairy products, processors, machinery and equipment of dairy processors. 3548 adds egg processors to the list of entities that could become exempt. And there is a dash one and a dash two for 3548 as well. And if you make a list.
All right, thank you. And
that's probably it. There are revenue, Mr. Chair, there are revenue impacts on each bill except for the dash one. On 3537, which deals with, and 3548, which deals with processors and dairy processors and egg processors, the impact statement there is roughly $1.5 million, $1.2 million for the 2009-11 biennium, and roughly $4.49 million for the 2007-09 biennium. That would be for 3548, which pertains to dairy processors and egg processors.
Now, that's the revenue impact.
3548.
I have a different set of numbers here.
The 3548.
Oh, I see. I'm looking at the wrong form. Yeah.
And for 3478, House Bill 3478, which only deals with dairy processors, the impacts are roughly $1.5 million. And about $400,000.
I do not see that.
Okay.
Sure, I guess I'm missing.
Would you show us where you're getting that?
Yes, I have a revenue impact statement for 3478.
Yes.
That's what we're looking at.
Mine's at
House Bill 3478. Okay. Starts out over in 0708 with a local government impact of $90,824. And a local school impact of $65,769. Okay. That's for an exemption on dairy processors only.
We thought we heard
millions in there. That was what was confused.
These are thousands.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we were hearing the word millions, and I think that either you misspoke or we misheard.
In other words, these are real numbers again, Mary.
These are real numbers.
Okay,
our numbers. Yeah.
All right, and the other bill would cost about $700,000 in the first biennium.
In House Bill 3548, which deals with dairy processors and egg processors, so we've added egg processors to this second bill. In 2007-08, local governments would lose $95,501, and local school districts would lose $69,156.
Okay, that's about $700,000. Is that right, altogether?
All in the out year? No, 96 and...
I guess I'm looking at the dash 2. I'm sorry.
Yes.
That adds more. That adds more to
it. Yes. He's looking at the dash 2. Now, if you go to the dash 2...
Oh, Gillian's here.
Oh.
Oh, there he is. Okay. He's snuck in while I wasn't looking. All right.
The dash 2 amendment takes dairy products, egg processors, and manufacturers of cookies, biscuits, and tortilla chips, and using the same data source, which actually breaks down employment by certain categories of employment in Oregon. It gets very refined. But using that data, your number for 2007-08 would be $132,615 for local governments and $96,032 for local school districts. The reason these numbers get so much larger as you move out away from 2007-08 is because each company that buys a machinery and gets an exemption in year one gets to take a five-year carry-forward position. So one in the first year becomes, let's say, two, in the second year becomes three, so if the multiples go out there. So by the time you get to 2009-11, in that second biennium, the numbers are substantially larger than they are in the first year.
And I'm assuming that in 11-13, they're larger yet.
Yes, and then it levels off, because
right,
at the end of
after the
five
year, years. Right.
It has to level off.
And you don't have 11-13 here.
No, I don't. It would be very simple to bump it out 1 year.
Okay. It's simply an arithmetic progression from what you've got.
That's correct.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Mr. Chair, while he's coming up, I see the eggs and dairy products, but I don't see that language dealing with cookies and biscuits.
And there is a dash one as well, which I didn't have time to prepare today. The dash one would pertain to dairy products, egg processors, and bakery goods. So it's more expansive than just cookies, biscuits, and tortilla chips.
Okay. I have it. But you didn't do it.
I didn't do the dash one, but it's going to be larger than the dash two, since it's more comprehensive.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It was not my intention to, I should say, I'm Vic Gilliam from District 18. I was appointed to fill the seat of Max Sumner. And it was not my intention to sneak in, and I will apologize.
I don't think you did that, Representative. I was so busy up here, I didn't see you coming.
Okay.
And I apologize.
Well, that's
that.
All right. I just want to apologize to anybody that I've been sneaky to.
Better get on that fast.
So, thank you very much. I'll be brief, except to say that I know that your job, at least as much as the Ways and Means, but your job more than any other committee is to look at the numbers. Am I making things buzz? And
dynamic personality.
Oh, thank you. Okay. All of us in our committees have to deal with numbers, but in my committees, in women's wellness and in consumer protection, those issues aren't quite as important. So I can't speak probably with the depth and wizardry that you might need to do the numbers, but there are those coming who can. But I want to say this. I've toured Willamette Egg, and that's what the egg amendment is designed for. I hope that other egg producers will benefit. But it's only about 20 minutes from here. It is in my district. It's this odd thing where its address says Canby, but it's actually very near between Woodburn and Molalla. And I was very impressed. And I want to emphasize that this is a great old Oregon company who has some wonderful employees and families involved. They have a very long tenure with their employees. They treat them very well. They're very good wage level, and they have great benefits. And it's a very impressive thing to take a tour, and I hope that I can arrange for you all to do that. I say that to emphasize the point. I really do believe this is an investment. This is not a startup. This is not an experiment. I believe that if we do this and allow them a little accommodation on the tax side, that our counties and everybody else that's depending on these funds, these the other property tax funds, will see benefits and see them very quickly, because they will multiply and create jobs. And I believe that very firmly. Most of these employees come out of either Representative Berger's district or Representative Comps. The plant just happens to be in my district. So I was very excited about my firsthand sort of tour and knowledge and questions of the owners and the managers and of the workers, and I wanted to pass that excitement I have on to you to say I really do believe that they're going to be around and they're going to create jobs, and this is a good investment. You're always helped when you're a rookie to do these kinds of things. And the first thing I learned my relating clause lesson in this bill, because we were all set with Representative Boone, who brought forward the dairy part, and the relating clause nightmare came to my attention. That's why you have two bills. And so I Representative Boone couldn't be here, but I am assured by her personally that she's fine with the new version of the bill, which is identical except for we've fixed the relating clause. Secondly, I was helped by a friend of mine, John Raymond, who I hadn't seen in years. John and I knew each other back in Washington, D.C. John went on to the Carter White House to fame and fortune, but he was smart enough to come back to Oregon and raise his family. And John is the one that introduced me to the folks at Willamette Egg, and their representative is here today. And that's who I would urge you to cross-examine, because I think he'll bring you the numbers that perhaps I'm not providing. I'm happy for any questions, but I don't want to belabor this.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative, yes.
Yes, I have a couple of questions for the good representative. Thank you, and I'm glad that we found a place to put in the eggs. And I understand the eggs, like you, I feel very strongly about cows and chickens. But I'm wondering what the goal or the purpose is of adding cookies, crackers, biscuits, and tortilla products. The makers of those things. I mean, it just seems like that's moving beyond the agricultural underpinnings of the dairy and the egg products.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Gelzer. I know a lot more about eggs than I do about the cookies, but I will say that I was convinced. I had been helped by the vehicle from Boone and Dairy, and I felt they made a good case that they, too, had a situation where this would do. I think their fiscal impact is less, if I'm not mistaken, than the egg, the cookies and tortillas.
I'm blinded by it.
And I felt under the same philosophy that they should be accommodated, but I cannot speak as specifically to that as I can about the eggs.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So I think that my only concern is that then we start looking at small businesses who, many of whom could benefit from tax credits or supports in upgrading of their mechanical infrastructure. And I understand more the policy priority of putting Oregon agricultural products kind of to the front of that tax credit line. And I just wonder what those issues open up, and maybe there's further witnesses. And with that, I thank you for being such a good egg.
Thank you.
Oh. That kind of cracked me up.
Unless there's a really serious additional question,
Mr. Chair,
for the good representative, I'd like to, because we're running very short of time, I'd like to talk to the Willamette Egg Farm and also the Northwest Food Processors Association.
You're letting him off so
easy.
If you don't mind, I just wanted to get on record that I have some deep, deep concerns about the many troubling aspects of his testimony. I just want to make sure that's on public record.
Mr. Chair, did you recognize him?
Yes, I did.
to Representative Gelser's testimony, I had the same questions regarding the cookies, the tortilla products. Made the assumption it was because it was his personal favorite foods, but then realized since cocktail olives and sardines were not on the list, that couldn't be true. But I don't know if he wants to comment to that or not, Mr. Chair. I just want to get that on record.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Anything further? Thank you. Thank you, thank Representative. You. And my suggestion is you beat a hasty retreat. although you may certainly stay to answer questions if you prefer. Dan Cunningham, Bruce Anderson. I will simply say first to the witnesses that this committee was meeting late last night.
That's true.
And if we look a little punchy, we may in fact be. Please, Mr. Cunningham.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dan Cunningham. I'm the president and one of the owners of Willamette Egg Farms. I'm pleased to testify today in favor of House Bill 3548, which would promote the efforts of our company to grow our value-added egg processing business and create new family wage jobs. House Bill 3548 would make dairy and egg processors eligible for the property tax exemption adopted for other food processors by the 2005 Legislative Assembly. The public policy behind that bill was to enhance the competitiveness of Oregon's food processing industry, which is a major employer. Willamette Egg Farms is a family-owned business, which was started in 1934. It started very small, picking up 10 to 20 cases per week of eggs from local farms and delivering them in Portland. Over the years, the company has grown into a business with multiple locations and over 2.5 million chickens.
Mr. Cunningham, I hate to interrupt, but I note you're reading your testimony.
Yes.
We do have it in writing. I'll ask the committee to read it. If you could hit the high points,
okay,
the really important points, given the lateness of our time today, that would be appreciated.
Okay.
Thank you.
The main point is in the third from the last paragraph where we provide 168 full-time family wage jobs in Oregon, and all of our employees are provided health and dental insurance and participated in 401k and profit sharing plans for the calendar year, and our payroll was close to $6 million. Our business is moving fast towards the added value side of the shell egg processing. In our gross sales last year, we were over 40% of our gross sales were in added value products, which is an enormous amount for a shell egg processing company. And that is where we are finding the most employment and the new jobs. And it is in this category that we seek the relief of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce Anderson, appearing before you with the Northwest Food Processors Association. I'm the new guy in this session for NWFPA, so it's a pleasure to appear before you all today. And thanks very much for your scheduling this bill so quickly as the timelines were approaching. Just a couple of things here I want to touch on and get to a couple of points, and I'll keep it brief. Northwest Food Processors Association was organized in 1914. We represent the food processing industry here in Oregon, along with Washington and Idaho. It's a foundational industry, and it's the third largest manufacturing sector in Oregon. We've got 17,000 employees with good average family wages, which result in about $500 million in total payroll here in the state. You've heard a little bit about some of the prior legislation that was passed in the 05 session. Senate Bill 479 was a hugely important piece of legislation for the primarily fruit and vegetable processing industry. But as a whole, the industry has really had some pretty significant struggles the last several years. We've seen declines in food processing employees and plants. Matter of fact, there was an article that came to our attention that I wanted to present you a copy of. It was in the Register Guard today regarding Foster Farms plant in Cresswell finally shutting down. But we've seen a lot of challenges in the industry the last several years, and we're working on some things in conjunction with the legislature and the governor's office in helping to turn that around. Why we feel that HB 3548, and that's the one I want to address specifically here today, is why it's necessary. It is mainly continuing on our primary, or one of our major goals as an organization, is to help the industry compete with other regions around the country as well as other countries around the world. The bill helps to support jobs and companies here in the state and helps in so many other different areas of economic development when we're able to bring these new upgrades to our technology, possibly even bringing online more energy efficient machinery and equipment, which is a major goal of our association, then that adds to the overall economic development. We've got some of those companies actually still producing machinery and equipment in this area, and so we see some side benefits there as well when we're able to retain the jobs and companies here, as we've seen in the article regarding the Foster Farms Cresswell plant. We're able to continue to have those companies supporting local government services. So I think there are a lot of extremely positive points to make on this. I did want to reference Dairy Gold was not able to be here today, but they are extremely interested in this. They've been instrumental in getting some legislation passed up in Washington State to help with that cooperative. It is a cooperative. I'm not going to say. I will just direct you to that testimony that Sharon Appelt, Dairy Gold's tax director, did mention. They have two plants here in Oregon, one in southeast Portland and then one in southern Oregon. And she makes some exceptionally good points regarding dairy processing in particular. We would just really appreciate your support for the legislation. One other point, if I could, Mr. Chair, we are supportive of the Dash 1 amendments. There were some aspects of Senate Bill 479 that were originally in the bill that were not able to carry forward at a certain point in 05. But those are some other areas, some extremely, again, good family wage jobs that are being supported here in the state. It might look like a little bit of a laundry list, but this is the industry as a whole does have some economic challenges, and one of the goals, again, of our association is just to do what we can to help keep our jobs here and help us help this region and help the folks in Oregon stay competitive. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yeah, Representative Berger.
Can I ask my question?
Sure.
You guys, in reading this, this is a huge universe, I think, in statute. And so I haven't walked into I've been to the Creamery Association. Okay, I know what they show me that they do there. But what about would this also apply to the dairy out on Highway 22 where they're milking the cows?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I'm not an expert, but I think this is this language in the bill applies to dairy processors. So I'm not.
That's not processing the milk and the cow and putting the truck and hauling it to the to the creamery. There's a head shake in the. I just want to put this on the record. Understand?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I'm just not that aware or that knowledgeable of the dairy industry. My understanding is that it's the process. Once it gets to the plant, that's when it starts getting processed into milk.
Well, but
and not at the dairy itself.
I got another committee meeting at 3, so let me get some more things on the record. Your eggs. You got the chickens. Are the chickens laying the eggs in your plant, Mr. Willamette Eggs?
Representative Berger and Mr. Chairman, we bring the eggs in from the farm, which are exempt already.
Okay, you're like the Creamery Association. You don't have the chickens. You get the eggs.
We have the chickens.
They're not
in the same building that the processing is.
The ones that gets the equipment.
Right.
Okay. I'm going real fast.
Sure.
What do they mean by personal property and machinery? I understand egg processing machinery, but what's personal property and machinery in this statute?
It's the process.
And I want the question answered by Mr. Gilliam.
Okay.
No, I don't. I'm sorry. I wouldn't hurry you if I didn't have somewhere I absolutely have to be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, my name is John Ramig. I'm with the Egg and O'Connell firm. We represent Willamette Egg Farms. To your question on what's required, there does have to be some value added. For example, the existing law speaks in terms of freezing, canning, dehydrating, concentrating, preserving, processing, repackaging. It's not enough to milk a cow or like an egg. There has to be more to it.
Thank you for that. And personal property machinery would be what kind of thing?
Machinery that's not fastened to the floor.
Exactly. Is that the statute?
Yes.
Okay. These were the questions that I wanted to get on the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, but one item of clarification that I wanted to just make, and that was my understanding was because this was adding to an existing program that there was already a sunset on that law in place, and I'm not sure if that is picked up in this legislation or not. So that would just be one issue I wanted to get on the record.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
With your permission, can I add one comment?
Yes.
I know there's some concern about revenue impact on this bill, and I wanted to give some perspective that's alluded to in Dan's testimony, but maybe not as clear as it could be. Willamette is scheduled to make investments of approximately $400,000 a year in new equipment and machinery. Their experience is that will create 8 to 10 new jobs per year. So if you kind of back out of that, the revenue impact of a $400,000 investment in year one before any depreciation is about $4,000. So if you think of any kind of economic development metric, to have $4,000 of investment, as Representative Gilliland spoke to, leverage 8 to 10 jobs, it's a home run from an economic development standpoint.
Thank you very much. And you can see I'm losing my committee. We have other witnesses to be heard on this bill. We're not going to be able to hear them today. I thought we were going to be able to move a little bit faster. But I will say to the Association of Oregon Counties and the Department of Revenue that if we reopen on this bill, we'll hear from you then. You're in the building. Thank you very much. And with that, we're going to close the public hearing on these two bills, and the committee is adjourned.